This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest portion of the show, the state of the presidential race. With polls showing Mitt Romney losing ground, are the debates his last chance?
The principles I have are the principles I've had from the beginning of my political life.
Also, we'll discuss whether the media are in the tank for Obama. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, The Queen of Versailles, a documentary about the splendid excess of the 1%. Also, the new TV show Revolution, in which all our gadgets abandon us. And if you look at an old movie and it seems hopelessly dated, is it unsophisticated or are you?
James Bond, that notorious, amazing Dr. No secret agent is back, and half the world is out to kill him.
Our show begins with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Joining me are Slate's chief political correspondent and political director of CBS News, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
Have you actually skewed any polls today?
No, I gave that up for Lent.
Lent?
Aha, that's not true because Lent isn't for months.
For me, it's always Lent. I'm in a constant state of
deprivation.
Self-deprivation, yeah.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello to both of you.
On today's show, we'll look at the flurry of polls and awkward moments that have Romney supporters worried. And we'll look ahead to what this means for next week's first debate. Then we'll examine the frequent claim that the news media are totally, completely, hopelessly in the tank for Barack Obama. And, of course, we will have cocktail chatter. So, a fog of gloom descended on Romney world this week. John, is it fair to call it a fog of gloom?
Yeah, it's sure. Let's call it a fog of gloom.
A fog of gloom.
It might also be a cape of despair. It might also be, you know, a helmet of troubles.
An isthmus.
A long black veil.
Oh, a long black veil is good. A long black veil descended on Mitt Romney today. So the bad data points, there were polls coming out of Ohio and Florida suggesting that Mitt Romney is in big trouble in those two states, which are basically both must-wins for him. And Republicans are beginning to pin their hopes for his campaign on the debates, which always seems to be a bad idea. The debates start on Wednesday night in Denver. Is that right, John? In
yes,
Colorado.
In Denver, yes.
Meanwhile, there's even grumbling in the right about whether some of the super PACs and the National Republican Party will redirect some of their campaign spending to try to win the Senate rather than spend it all on Mitt Romney and winning the presidency, the sense that maybe the presidency has already been lost and thus the Republicans should focus on winning what can still be won. So, John, what happened with these polls in Ohio and Florida, but particularly in Ohio, that got Democrats so excited?
Well, over the last 10 or so days, even 2 weeks or so, the polls have started to widen in Ohio. So what started happening was the president was beating Romney among registered voters and then started to be able to beat him among likely voters. Normally, Republicans do better among when you screen for likely voters because Republicans turn out more than Democrats do. Then the president started to move outside of the margin of error with likely voters, and it was consistent. It was in the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. It was in the Fox poll. It was in the Washington Post poll. It was now in the New York Times, Quinnipiac, CBS poll. So basically, the old cliche, no Republican has won the White House without winning Ohio. If Romney doesn't win Ohio, he basically has to run the table of the rest of the battleground states. And so these numbers are showing up in internal Republican polls, too. So there's a problem in Ohio for Romney, which suggests there's a big problem for his campaign.
So, Emily, why would Ohio be so favorable to President Obama in this situation? I mean, it's not as though Ohio is demographically, it's not like a Connecticut or New York. It's not East Coast liberals or West Coast liberals. It's a very traditionally Republican state.
True. It's been helped by the auto bailout. So it's possible some of the white working class men who tend to break away from Obama have nice feelings about him because of that. And I was also reading this week that Obama's problem with white men has more to do with region. It's stronger in the South than it is in the Midwest. And so maybe we've been kind of overemphasizing that in our analysis.
Right. And Ohio has a lower unemployment rate than the country as a whole. So the economy is It's not great in Ohio, but it's relatively better than it is elsewhere.
He lost.
Did you just ask me a question when you had the better answer at your hand? I feel like I failed a quiz.
That is true of me all the time, yeah, Emily. Right. I just hold it in my back pocket.
One really felt like, ooh, whoops.
So also, another thing is that if the white working class vote in Ohio, Obama lost by 10 points to John McCain in 2008. He is always going to, he's likely to lose it even this time, the white working class vote. But if he can lose it by 3 points and the turnout is lower, then his voters can turn out and win the day in Ohio. So it's not only that you get some white working class voters who might like him because of the auto bailout and because of the improved economy in Ohio, but also it could be that they were angered by the John Kasich's effort to remove collective bargaining from unions, Governor John Kasich of Ohio. And then finally, the ads that ran over this early summer attacking Mitt Romney for his career at Bain were aimed right at suppressing that white working class vote in Ohio. The white non-college educated vote in Ohio is almost 50% of the vote. So this is a pretty big group. So those are all other reasons.
John, what are the Romney folks going to do? Because I'm sure they think Ohio is an absolute must win.
Well,
right?
and one of the reasons.
What are they going to do?
It's a problem because they've been trying with these ads talking about how Obama has gutted welfare to appeal to those white working class voters, arguing basically that Obama's doing something to make it easy for lazy people to get a check, and that didn't work. That's the really dangerous thing about what's happening in Ohio for Romney is that they've been involved in a gambit to help bump up this vote, and it hasn't worked. So
you can say it ain't working. That's very colloquial.
That's right. People recognize my deep southern roots of across the Potomac River. So that's the other problem is that they have used one of their pieces of weaponry in Ohio, and it doesn't seem to be working. Which gets boring.
Emily, let us change topics briefly. So one thing that's happened with this Romney slide is the sense that he's got to turn it around in the debates. The debates are going to save him. That's where he's got his chance to win. So what can he do, if anything, in the debates, which begin next week, and there are four of them, 3 presidential, 1 vice presidential, what can he do that can actually flip things around?
I don't actually think he can do anything. I think Obama can blow it.
How can Obama blow it?
Obama can mess up and say something really stupid or look at his watch or, you know, sigh heavily. There are all kinds of little ways that candidates have screwed up in debates. You know, he can pull a Mike Dukakis and react totally unemotionally when someone asks him about the murder of his wife. There are lots of things he could do wrong, which all seem unlikely to me, but he could stumble in some new and exciting way, and then that can become the news. I mean, Romney has to do well. He has to perform masterfully. But the best thing he does, I just don't see how it really changes the dynamics of the race.
Well, as the resident person who still thinks that Mitt Romney is going to win the election, I would offer 2 counter arguments to that.
Yet another moment in which you seem to have a real answer up your sleeve.
I'm sorry. Did you not know that we were going to talk about the debates? Did you not think about this beforehand?
No, it's the tone here. Go ahead.
Well, no, my 2 points are that it seems to me that Mitt Romney has failed as a candidate in 2 significant ways. One, he has failed to make himself a person that anyone actually likes. So the sort of pleasure in his company factor, he's losing badly. Everything he does makes you think, I really don't want to be around this guy. That's number one. Number two is that he has failed because he has run a campaign with absolutely no substance to it. He has not articulated a single substantive policy that anyone can remember, and he seems to be a conscious negative void of a campaign. And the debates would seem to offer a chance to address both of those huge failings at once. I'm not saying that Romney actually will succeed in doing it, but if he managed to come out with a cannon full of policy papers and amazing specificity and incredible arguments about exactly what he would do as president that's different from what President Obama is doing, that might be a substantive victory that's actually significant. That's number one. And number two, he might appear to be a credible, likable person who you'd be happy to spend 4 years with.
Yeah, I just don't think that's going to be enough anymore.
John, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think we know a couple of things. One, the debates actually often don't matter as much as we think they do. And so arguably the one that did matter is Al Gore's against George W. Bush in 2000. I would add another thing is that if you go back and look at the polls going all the way back to 1952, the majority of candidates who are ahead at this point go on to win. The only ones who didn't were Reagan, Kennedy, and George W. Bush. Reagan was basically tied. Kennedy and George W. Bush were behind. George W. Bush is the most recent example of a candidate who was behind and who the debates helped. I think it's unlike – I mean, the president would have to – it's almost hard to imagine the level of screw-up he would need to create such a problem with him. I mean, the problem for Mitt Romney is Mitt Romney. It's not Barack Obama. And Mitt Romney has to find a way to be something more. He hasn't been able to close the sale. He's got to find a way to close the sale. And it may in part benefit him that he's gotten the stuffing kicked out of him for the last 3 weeks, because if you looked at him in that 60 Minutes interview he did last Sunday, he came across as a perfectly competent guy whose ideas, when you hear them in the four corners of the show, seem reasonable. He seems thoughtful. He seems like a perfectly reasonable fellow. And for a lot of people who will be turning in, and this might be the first time they've ever really considered him and paid close attention to him, hey, he might look okay.
What's the format of the first debate?
I think it's just questions and,
answers?
You sort of,
it's not like we're sitting on a couch together.
No, and
we're
it's
on
not,
a date.
Not town hall or
we're
anything.
Having like a, we're at a bar.
No, nothing like that. Yeah.
Obama orders a beer. Romney right. doesn't know what to order.
Right.
It all falls apart.
John, to your point that it might, you know, if people haven't tuned in until now and he seems warm and magnetic and like someone you would love to hang out with, that might be enough. Don't you think even those people would then bounce that view off of people who would, around them who would say like, oh my God, but you should have, didn't you hear about what he said? I mean, is he really operating that much in a vacuum at this point?
Yeah. Well, it depends. Yes. And remember, we were talking about the people who are undecided and who they are and how much they sort of sit down with a pencil and all the position papers and weigh equally each side. People take impressions all kinds of funny ways. I think you're right. I think the connectivity in the course of a debate would have to be awfully strong. It's almost, the problem is that a debate is a cool medium. It's hard to convey this connectivity that we're talking about in a debate setting. It's also hard for Mitt Romney over the course of his career to do that. So I think those are the bigger obstacles. But I think, you know, you're probably right. I mean, the reason people are skeptical and that there hasn't been a kind of embracing of Romney even throughout his own party's primary is there's just something about him. So I think, you know, one strong debate performance would help, but there will still be enough time for people to get out of that thinking.
Well, we will find out if Mitt Romney has all that charisma for our show next week. Coming up, do the media have it in for Mitt Romney? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Amid the general dispiritment of Republicans this week, there has arisen a powerful new resentment, which is the resentment that the media is in the tank for President Obama. The Media Research Center, a right-wing media watchdog, sent a letter to a whole bunch of news organizations accusing them of rampant, unprecedented bias against Mitt Romney and for the president. So, Emily, why do you think this sense of resentment is emerging right now?
Well, because Romney's falling behind and there's all this reporting about the polls showing his lag. But, you know, I also feel like there is this kind of basic truth, or at least reality, which is that a lot of people in the press are left-leaning or liberal or Democrats. And so I can certainly imagine that a Republican candidate would feel that his or her ideas and whole party identity was not the one that the reporters were kind of inherently inclined to be hugely sympathetic to. It's not universal, and it doesn't speak to whether a lot of the reporters really can be fair. I mean, I think John could talk more about that. My sense is people bend over backwards to be fair often. But I could certainly imagine that you feel like you're talking to people who just don't totally share your worldview.
I've definitely found in the last few weeks, and I'm not on the campaign trail, so John, you should jump in and correct me here. But as the bad news for Romney piled up, as the Democrats had a relatively successful convention and the Republicans had a relatively unsuccessful one, and the polling started to lean towards President Obama when the 47% video came out, there was a sense of glee I felt among my compatriots, which wasn't the sense of glee that, oh, there's now drama in the race. It was a sense of glee like, phew, we know we're headed towards an Obama victory. Now let's just get on for the ride.
But you mean you don't mean reporters. You mean people who are in the Opinion magazine.
It's more like it's not.
Yeah, those are all like left leaning.
Well, it's not. Some of it is those people. Some of it is people who are more reportorial. I'm sure you have not let a scintilla of glee. You don't feel any glee at whatever is happening to one candidate or another. But there's so much enthusiasm about that 47% video from journalists, and it wasn't simply. I didn't feel like it was simply there's a good story out. It was that there's, look at this, let's go in for the kill.
Yeah, I think you got to pull apart what you mean by journalists. So there
are
people.
Yeah, you're in broad brush.
Yeah, I know. So there are people who write.
I'm trying to set you guys up. I'm trying to set John up to get on his high horse here.
There are people who.
You did that successfully.
There are people who write about politics who are, you know, who don't report about it, who just have thousands of opinions. And lots of them are liberal. Some of them hide it. Some of them don't. But they don't, their opinion. People. And then there are people who write about other stories who are sort of health or science or maybe even business reporters who tend to be liberal, but it doesn't really affect their day-to-day reporting life completely. And those people may be the group that you're talking about. I think the people who have to cover this day-to-day, I think in that group, I think you still have some people who are not ideologues. Because if you're an ideologue, being a reporter is not the place to go. You would go do one of those other things. You'd be one of those opinion people because it's just easier than being a reporter. But on the other hand, if you look at these polls, every poll that's been taken in September that's not a Rasmussen poll, Obama has been ahead. I mean, it's very hard. And also, by the way, when you do the reporting with the Republican campaign, people are saying, oh, geez, our internal polls are bad, too. So there's a story there that shows things going badly for Mitt Romney. Plus, you talk to people raising money for him. Things are going badly, too. So there is a story, an actual story to cover. But I think there is in the reporting press who covers politics. I think Emily's basic point is right.
See, and I want to argue.
But there's not glee. It's just that their worldview tends to be they don't come at it to the extent they come at it with a worldview. I don't think it's a huge one, but it's not often a conservative worldview.
I want to argue with you about this slightly, which is that it seems to me one change from in 2012 that's somewhat different from 2008 and certainly different from what used to be in 2004 is that a lot of the political reporters are actually reporters for outlets that have a distinct bias. So that if you think about the reporters who work for a place like Huffington Post or Talking Points Memo or Fox News, there are people who are reporters and their job is a news gathering job, but it's also a news gathering job for an organization which has a vested interest or has a dog in the fight. And I don't think there are that many people, and you are truly one of them, John, and so that's to your credit. But there are relatively fewer people who are completely separated from a rooting interest.
Well, a rooting interest is slightly different than a political interest. So that, for example, you can imagine, and there were definitely people who in 2000, when the Supreme Court decision was being made about Bush v. Gore, there were people who had a rooting interest who had been covering Bush for him to win because then they would get to cover the White House, which has nothing to do with ideology. In fact, most of those people, if you were to reach into their soul, you'd probably find that they were more left-leaning than right-leaning. But they wanted Bush to win.
But they probably cared more about whether they were going to get to go to the White
Precisely.
House. I know those feelings overcome my political sensibilities all the time.
So my point is that there's the Huffington Post and that kind of thing, but there are all kinds of people who are on the daily plane who, you know, 80% of them, 90% of them are from old-fashioned news organizations.
So let's go to the poll question just briefly because, John, I know this is a is a fixation of yours.
You're afraid to let John loose.
Which is that there is this guy who started a website called Unskewed Polls, in which he is claiming that essentially the pollsters are fudging the polls to overrepresent Democrats in their polling samples and thus show President Obama in the lead. And if you stop using these skewed samples, you would see that actually Mitt Romney's in the lead. Now, this seems to me to be just a sad, desperate argument, given that every other pollster who seems to be looking at these numbers has reached the same conclusions. But why is this person getting any attention? Why should we even talk about him? Maybe we shouldn't.
Well, he's getting attention because what else can you do if you're a Republican and support Mitt Romney? And it would be true if a Democrat were behind. And it was true in the primaries in 2008. So you're behind. You argue about the methodology because you can't. You're down 7 points. You have to say, well, the 7 points isn't a real 7 points. And there's enough wiggle room in the science of polling. There's enough difficulties, whether it's making your turnout guesses, deciding what does make somebody a likely voter or not. There are enough questions about the polling that you can raise doubts about any individual poll. But when all of the polls show currents moving in the same direction in lots of different ways, it's basically the last argument you can have when your guy's not winning.
I mean, this sort of loops back, but it's also important to point out that you can have strong partisan views and not have them leading how you conduct your professional life every day, because other values come into play and you take on the identity of your tribe. And if your tribe is to strip yourself of those partisan views, then that's what you do.
Absolutely. That's such a great point. I'm really glad you got back to that, because I know people who are in the business who are it's almost certain they vote Democratic, and they are some of the toughest reporters on this Democratic administration and create news on a regular basis that helps Mitt Romney. And so party affiliation in your heart for a lot of reporters is just basically meaningless. In fact, arguably, they go the other way because they want, as you say, Emily, since the tribe values people who are straight up, they work extra hard to make sure that they're seen that way.
What is in your heart, John? You don't have to reveal that. Let's turn to cocktail chatter. When you run into a despondent NFL replacement referee drinking his sorrows away in a bar, how are you going to cheer him up, John Dickerson?
I am going to cheer him up by showing him this photograph, which you all may already know about. But it's the first photograph ever of human beings. It's from 1838. It's a daguerreotype or daguerreotype. I can never
daguerreotype.
Daguerreotype of a Parisian village. City goes too far. And it took 10 minutes of exposure for the image to set, and so none of the street traffic could be recorded in the photograph. But a Parisian was getting his boots shined, and as a result, he and the boot black were stationary for 10 minutes. And so in this big photograph, you can see two little figures who are captured, and it's just a great photo. And we'll put it on our Facebook page, and we'll tweet it out. We'll also come to your house and stick a copy of it up on the refrigerator.
Emily, what's your chatter about?
I'm chatting about John's awesome fresco project. That's our word for big, lengthy, exciting, dug into projects at Slate. And having watched John carry around a whole suitcase full of books to our Slate retreat and hearing about him doing it elsewhere, I just want to say that it was actually worth it, because he has written a series about what we would actually really want to find out in a job interview or long application process for the presidency. Forget the campaign and all of its emphasis on things that prove to be relatively inconsequential. What do we actually need to know about this person's management skills, their political skills, and how they knock heads together and get things done? So you should all go read it. It's really, I've only read the beginning, but it's so far terrific.
Mega dittos.
Thanks, guys.
Many listeners kindly alerted me to the fact that the baby panda at the Washington National Zoo died suddenly this past week. Now, of course, any death of any creature is sad, and I will not use this moment to express my true feelings about pandas here, which they're stupid and evolutionarily backwards and they're boring. I'm not going to talk about that. I instead want to rant about how the Washington Post, which of course is the newspaper that brought us Watergate, which is the newspaper
of
record, which does not own us. The newspaper doesn't own us. The corporation
owns
us. Went all in on the death of the 6-day-old baby panda. They did 3 separate stories about how to explain the death of the panda to your child. They had about 6 or 7 other stories about the baby panda's death. there was a piece that was literally headlined, Remembering a Panda Cub We Barely Knew, which compared the death of a six-day-old panda to a family that lost five children before the age of 12. It literally compared them to that.
Oh, my God, that's awful.
It was awful. It's awful. The excess here is ridiculous. And, of course, I would just point out that the panda mother seems absolutely unperturbed by this. She is eating happily. She's sleeping soundly, the zookeepers report. And one story reassured us that she was a great mom because, quote, she did not crush the cub. So that'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Search for Slate Political GabFest in iTunes. I'm David Plotz in Washington, handing you off to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest Long Shoots of Goldenrod edition. On today's show, the new and remarkable documentary about having and having not the Queen of Versailles, plus the new NBC hour-long series Revolution, and finally, You're Watching It Wrong. Has irony destroyed our capacity to appreciate the art of the past properly? Joining me today are Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, our film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
All right. Well, Dana, let me dig in with you, film critic. Queen of Versailles is a new documentary by a woman named Lauren Greenfield. It's about David Siegel, a timeshare magnate, and his wife, Jackie, and their attempt to build what would have been the largest private residence in the United States, a 90,000-square-foot-plus Leviathan that would have included 30 bathrooms, 10 kitchens, 2 tennis courts, a bowling alley, a skating rink, a sushi bar, and $5 million worth of marble. And they called it, without irony, Versailles. Along the way, Mr. Siegel's business empire begins to falter. Their lives falter along with it. And in the wake of the credit crisis, they do the unthinkable. They lay off staff, they clean up after themselves, and they fly commercial. Dana, I can't imagine someone not having a pretty intense reaction to this documentary. What was your reaction?
Well, first of all, I would definitely recommend it highly, if only because the subject matter is so bizarre and fascinating. And it's one of those rare documentaries, a great break for the documentarian, where Lauren Greenfield, who was originally a photographer and then conceived of this project, I think after having photographed the couple, the Siegels, had this happenstance change the story of her film. She started off in 2007 making a movie about the largest house in America that they were having built in Florida. And sure enough, in 2008, when the credit crisis came along, she found her story to be about something entirely different. It also, in a very fascinating way, is this story of nested credit crises, right? Because David Siegel's money all comes from selling timeshares, essentially, which are sort of subprime mortgage timeshares for people who can't really afford them. So he is being exploited by the banks in the same way that he is exploiting his own consumers. And it all just becomes this kind of dizzying mirror of capitalism. It's a fascinating movie.
Julia, a dizzying mirror of capitalism. What did you make of the cameras being let into these extraordinary lives? I mean, if nothing else, right, aren't you amazed at the absolute ubiquity of the reality TV mindset by which anybody opens their front door to let a camera in and examine them? Remarkable, right?
Yeah, I still can't really figure out what the motives were of Jackie Siegel and her husband in letting the cameras into their lives, but they're remarkably open and candid, and it seems like the filming took place over several years. I think I read somewhere that Lauren Greenfield and her crew would show up for a couple days at a time every month or so. And in fact, it's come out this year that the family has in fact sued the filmmaker, and I think it's unclear how the suit has been resolved at this point. But, you know, I found them remarkably sympathetic, really surprisingly sympathetic. Did you like this family? I mean, you don't go into the movie expecting to like them because you think, oh, these crazy opulent weirdos. But particularly Jackie is sort of smart and charming, I thought.
Yeah, Julia, to me, there's almost an emotional roller coaster ride in terms of your engagement with these two people, because Jackie is really a screen filler. She's a huge personality. She's 30-something years younger than her husband and seems like one of the children, one of their seven, they have seven children of their own and another child who came into the family later on. So they're bringing up eight kids. And one of the kids says at one point, I think my mom was a trophy wife, right? It's not something that's ever right out on the surface. And it seems like a real marriage, but it's also a very, very strange relationship because she seems like a compulsive shopper and she's kind of crazy. But yeah, she is an engaging, warm person who's very down to earth with the photographers and the people following her around. So you find yourself engaging. But then when you see the way they live and some moments of excess that are just so kind of contemptible, then you swing the other way again.
Yeah, we should say that this documentary premiered several months ago. It's rolling out slowly across the country. It comes out on DVD on November 13th. Many people listening to our show probably haven't heard it. I think maybe we should just give them a little taste to give them some feel for it.
We never sought out to build the biggest house in America. It just kind of happened.
It's bigger than the White House.
2 tennis courts.
30 bathrooms.
Full-size baseball field.
10 kitchens.
Antique furniture.
90,000 square feet.
Oh, my God.
No, that's not my room. That's my closet.
No way.
We're in line to do $1 billion in sales for the year. We're on top of the world. And it came to a screeching halt.
We don't talk about financial problems. I guess I'll have to watch the movie to find out what's going on in my life.
But Julia, let me take a slight issue with you. I do believe that there's a kind of polite or sophisticated response to this movie by which you do not take too much pleasure in their comeuppance and you make an effort to see the human story at the center of it. And not at the end of the day to feel too much schadenfreude for these people who maybe at the end of the film it suggested may be in danger of losing substantially all of his fortune. However, that was not my reaction at all. My reaction was this documentary shows the degree to which a class of people in this country got so rich during the boom years that they felt that they were, first of all, completely immune to the normal laws of human character. And second of all, a completely distinct species from the rest of us. She's forced to approach a Hertz counter. God forbid she doesn't get a stretch limo to appear immediately after the indignity of flying commercial has been forced upon her. She's forced to approach a Hertz counter. She asks what the name of her driver will be. The person can only look back at her in total astonishment. But the most remarkable one, the one that really floored me, almost physically, I almost fell over when she said it, is when she realizes that they're going to lose a lot of what they have, they need to scapegoat someone for this massive reversal of fortune, and they scapegoat something called the bankers, who admittedly are circling his business like a bunch of vultures. Fine, but that's the way the system that he got rich on works, okay? She has the gall to look at the camera and say, the bankers, it's the bankers. I mean, after all, we bailed out the bankers. Suddenly she's a citizen, right? We, the citizens, bailed out the bankers 2 years ago. Some of that money, wasn't that money supposed to flow through to the common people, to us? I mean,
well, I want to jump in though, Steve, because I mean, you're right. It's a sickening portrait of our financial system. But I think the film is a much more interesting film than it would have been if it had been entirely unsympathetic to this family and full of schadenfreude at their losses and the fact that they'll never get to use the $5 million worth of marble from China that they have waiting in a garage for the building of Versailles. Versailles 2, Versailles Orlando, or Versailles, as the woman who's eventually hired to sell it calls it. Because I think the family ends up being, in a really surprising way, a metaphor for the classic American family who overspent their means and found themselves screwed by the financial crisis in a way that's totally shocking given the scale on which they're living.
Dana, I think only in the way that a cancer cell is a hyperbolic version of a normal, healthy one. I mean, at the end of the day, what we see are these people perhaps having to make do with their 26,000 square foot house and never getting to move into their 90,000 square foot house. Some sacrifice.
I think, Steve, that you're over-focusing on whether or not we should like or care about the Siegels. I mean, it seems to me, I agree with Julia, that this movie, almost the movie itself, kind of metastasizes into so many other things than the Siegels. And although it is key that we have some sort of ambivalence in our relationship to them, especially her, but it doesn't seem like the focus is meant to be our moral valence in relation to the Siegels.
I totally agree, Dana. This documentary is not made with the rage that I'm experiencing from watching it.
But we haven't mentioned something that I think you really go to this movie for, which is the incredible details of the luxury that the Siegels live in. I mean, there's just – if you like MTV Cribs, if you have some enjoyment in seeing the sort of tacky luxury that the super rich surround themselves with, this movie's got – taxidermy dogs in glass cases and what other kind of crazy extravagant
princess staircases. Actually, my favorite scene in the whole movie is this scene that just wordlessly passes toward the beginning where you see this bathroom and the bathroom is filled with sort of knockoffs of ancient Grecian statues, sort of fake Venus de Milo's or whatever.
Or real ones.
Who can say? And the bathroom appears to have like three or four jacuzzis in the one bathroom and has like a view of the ocean. And you see this nanny cleaning two kids in the foot of this cavernous tub, which clearly would take hours to fill because it's so big. So she just has them splashing around in the bottom and she has to lean across this expanse of marble counter to even reach the bottom of the tub where the kids are frolicking in the suds. And that seemed to me like just a metaphor for the insane scale of the entire house and their entire lives.
My God, you people are so into metaphors. I want actual heads on actual spikes.
All right, what was your favorite detail?
My imagining actual heads on actual spikes. No, my favorite detail is like pets dying in wings of the house that people haven't visited clearly in weeks. I mean, it's just...
Oh, Steve, that was the saddest detail for me. There's a moment when, as the financial crash is really getting bad and they're realizing that they might lose everything, Jackie confesses to the camera that her children may actually have to go to college and have careers. And you suddenly realize that they've been bringing up 8 children with the assumption that they will all be rich scions for the rest of their life. And that was a moment that I really had trouble getting any compassion back for Jackie again.
Spectacularly weird. All right. Well, we could add detail upon detail. We recommend people go see the film when it becomes available to them. The Queen of Versailles. Coming up, your irony is ruining my viewing experience. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. Revolution is the new show from executive producer J.J. Abrams, best known for the hit TV show Lost. It's also from Eric Kripke, who's best known for the CW show Supernatural. Revolution takes place in an America in which, as a character says, physics went insane, nobody knows why, and electricity suddenly did not work. What results is a Jared Diamond-like collapse, a universe filled with abandoned and overgrown structures and hulking machines, through which the remnants of the Matheson family move on a quest to find out why the lights went out and how possibly to restore them. Let's listen to a clip from Revolution.
I'm going to have to ask you to come with us under the authority of the Monroe Republic.
Why?
Do I have to repeat myself?
I just don't understand.
Here's what you need to understand. I have been searching for you for a very long time through mud and filth, away from my home and my wife and my bed. So I'm in a mood. I'm sure you can understand that. So do yourself a favor and climb in that wagon. Or so help me, I will conscript all of your children and I will re-educate them until they no longer remember your names.
Julia, as I understand it, jury's still out on whether or not this is going to be a monster hit. We all watched Revolution, the pilot. What'd you think of the show?
I wish it were better. I mean, I think the premise of the show is interesting, right? We've seen a lot of fantastical post-apocalypse fictions lately, right? Like there's Walking Dead, which gives you zombies as a metaphor for life after the collapse of modern society. We talked about the Steven Soderbergh movie Contagion, which is sort of a hyper-realistic portrait of the collapse of society in the face of a pandemic. Even The Hunger Games, you know, a wildly popular series, is about a grotesque post-apocalypse full of craven reality TV aficionados, oppression and woe, and a strappy hunter girl in a leather jacket as the hero Katniss, after whom I think our hero Charlie in the show is perhaps modeled. And I liked the idea of a technological version of this as a post-apocalypse that comments more narrowly on our dependence, fixation, obsession with technology these days and all of the things that electricity begets us. There's a lot of like good potential there, and there's some good actors too, particularly in the form of Giancarlo Esposito, who was so fantastic on Breaking Bad and who is pretty great chewing through the scenery as a baddie warlord aide in this world we find ourselves in 15 years after the power goes out. But I don't know. I feel like the main actress is not quite up to the task, and the writing is not quite up to the task.
Well, it has this very basic network TV problem. It seems like this happens a lot on shows on the big networks, where the story is focused on the wrong people. It's sort of this story about these teenagers who are ultimately very dull characters. And then some of the more interesting ones, like the Giancarlo Esposito villain, who we don't know much about yet, or Billy Burke, who I'm probably the only one of the three of us who saw and to some extent liked all the Twilight movies. This is the guy who plays Kristen Stewart's dad in Twilight, and I liked Billy Burke too. But the adults seem very marginal, and there's a lot of time spent on these very telegenic teenagers going around shooting crossbows.
Yeah, being like, we gotta band together because we're family. And meanwhile, this whole world that we're seeing a portrait of is kind of fascinating. And there's this warlord culture that has arisen. And everybody who, you know, the American flag is now a sign of the rebel insurrection that wants to restore the old order and laws of the society that collapsed. People are wearing leather and riding horses. It's
sort of an agrarian look, right, to society only 15 years after the collapse. So this is another thing I didn't like about this show, and this is maybe something that will be developed in future episodes, but I felt like the dystopia it provided was a little bit sloppy in its details, and it seems to me the interesting part is to see how does this dystopia work.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dan. I think the best thing this show has going for it is the thought experiment nature of it. People are probably tuning in principally at first for that, right? That this is just a great idea. Airplanes all fall out of the sky. It happens totally simultaneously. In an instant, electricity is no longer viable for reasons that are completely obscure. What does the world look like? Like, people who are formerly underdogs are now overdogs, right? I mean, you know, slaves become masters. I mean, the whole sort of dialectic of power between people shifts in a world that suddenly is once again pre-modern. Nonetheless, I kind of liked it. I think it has some promise. I thought it was smart, but every fear is a repressed wish, Julia. And it seems to me that the spate of post-apocalyptic fantasy says something about a current malaise, and people would love secretly a cataclysm to throw off that malaise and sort of allow us to prove our mettle the way our yeoman ancestors had to on a more or less daily basis. Is there, and this has been discussed already, is the wish a little bit a right-wing wish here, a world ruled by militias, a world more ruled by kind of decentralized tiny communities trying to make it on their own? Is there a political undertone here?
Well, I don't think the show portrays the world of decentralized militias as a positive future for us all, in which the skills we've cultivated at the local co-op, tending arugula and shearing sheep, will finally come in handy.
There is an aggressive message in the first one, that the fact that what central authority there is has banned firearms is the basis of their ability to keep their boot on the neck of the populace. I don't think I'm alone in picking up this note of right-wing populism to the show.
Oh, that's true. I hadn't thought about that. I think the show plays it both ways, though. On the one hand, we have the evil warlord who's trying to keep guns out of the hands of the populace, and if only they had guns, perhaps they could overthrow. But in the second episode, you see a team of rebels banding together, and one of them has an American flag tattoo, and they're really trying to overthrow the warlord and reinstate civil society. Although, on the other hand, the plot does center around them trying to steal a high-powered rifle. So maybe this is just a Second Amendment show, Steve. I've totally been boondoggled.
No wonder I loved it.
But Dana, you haven't weighed in on the apocalypse fantasy thing. I mean, do we fantasize about the apocalypse because we want to be reduced to a pre-modern state and prove that we can shear sheep? Or why are we scaring ourselves with these post-apocalypses?
Yeah, it's such a huge question. It's almost hard to know how to even take it on. It's been happening in film, too, for a long time. And since before September 11th, right, we were also destroying our cities and bringing them down and watching weeds go through them. And it seems like this goldenrod growing through the Ferris wheel thing is something we want to return to again and again and again. I mean, the only explanation I could think of maybe is that everybody senses that it's already happening. It's happening in slow motion with global warming or the financial crisis or war or whatever. And people want to sort of fast forward to the end and see what it's going to look like.
Yeah. Well, may I never find out what stuff I'm really made of. That's all I can say. All right. Well, finally, the television critic Matt Zoller cites went to see the James Bond film From Russia with Love in a small, packed venue, and the movie was greeted with a lot of hipster backtalk, the ironically self-aware laughter of presumably 20 and 30-somethings who could not believe that a movie could be so old-fashioned and silly, all while thinking itself so sexy and daring, at which point Matt Zollersites took to the internet and produced a rant. Some of the patrons seemed truly deeply, so he wrote, unironically into the film, but many more seemed to be treating it as a nostalgia trip. The very qualities that made the film seem modern and exciting when it came out amused them. The film's lack of newness prevented connection with the audience. It wasn't the film's fault. It was the audience's. I hate to be the guy who says you're watching it wrong, but these people definitely were. Dana, this has gotten a huge amount, so much of a response on the internet that Matt Zollersites has written a second response to those reactions. It's created a dialogue among people in the critical community and non-critical community, among civilians as well, about what the proper response to a work of art should be. What struck you about this debate?
I think more than anything else, and the real reason we're talking about it, is how huge the response was. To me, it seemed rather odd that people responded so strongly. It was an anecdote about one movie that he saw and one audience. I think everyone's probably had that experience, particularly in college, and he actually has a long digression. He ends on this story of a college class that went similarly, and the film professor chewing out the students in much the way that Matt Zollersites chews out the people he saw From Russia With Love with. But I think that that direct address that comes up in his article that sort of implies that you are watching it wrong if you are doing these things really got people where they live. And essentially, a lot of people push back with, we don't want to be told how to see a film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Julia, I'm curious what struck you about the tone of his rant.
You leave a lot of room for interpretation with your use of the noun rant.
He called it a rant. I'm using his word. Did you find it a way of telling people that they ought to be open, more open and more liberal in some sense in their responses to work of art or less so?
Well, I thought the tone of the rant was curmudgeonly and somewhat off-putting, but I did think it raised an interesting question, which is how should you, the viewer, relate to works of art produced in the past? I mean, that's primarily what he's talking about. The two examples are From Russia With Love and Singing in the Rain, and a lot of the responses to the piece have also talked about films from the past and pointed out, you know, there's a reason we call certain classics timeless. It's that they seem to still cast the same spell for audiences today that they did for audiences years ago. And there are other things that don't necessarily translate, or for them to translate, you have to kind of set yourself back into a different mindset. I mean, I remember even seeing, and I think he or someone in this debate mentions 3 Days of the Condor. I remember seeing 3 Days of the Condor, and just when you watch a suspense film from 30 or 40 years ago, the pacing of a suspense film is very different than the pacing of a suspense film today. And you have to sort of set yourself back into a mindset where you find a scene that doesn't have a cut for minutes and minutes at a time suspenseful, which is no longer the language of suspense in the cinema today. I think it's a useful experiment to kind of go back and try and experience things as someone might have looked at them in the past. But I also think it's crazy to suggest that viewers should turn off their modern responses as well, and that they should view something without all the information that they've culled from the films they've seen from their own time.
Yeah, and also not only film, but satire from their own time. And the problem partially is Mike Myers has so successfully spoofed this genre, it's impossible to go back and see it fresh.
Well, and as many commenters also point out, James Bond is already camp from the beginning.
Well, but right? I would even go one step further and say, you know what, all of what we now take to be the natural pacing of a film derives from the early James Bond movies. And so it seems to me there are several simultaneous confusions going on here in this rant, some of which I quite agree with. But where I think the critical distinction is drawn is between the example he gives of the James Bond film, which is incredibly weak because it's based on a James Bond film, and the example he gives of Singing in the Rain. And there, it's not only is the film, you know, a widely admired American film classic that a set of students in his film class were completely incapable of appreciating for the self-professed reason that they were too immersed in the style of MTV to accept what they were seeing on screen, namely Gene Kelly kind of mugging it up and people bursting spontaneously into song, and the context in which it was shown, which was a film class in which presumably you ought to be able to strike the attitude of looking back into the past on its own terms. And that did strike me as a massive deficiency on the part of his fellow students. But that is a completely different example from the one he gives of hipsters laughing at Miss Moneypenny.
But I also think his description of the response of the teacher, which is to hector the students and yell at them for having had the, quote, wrong response to Singing in the Rain, seems like an insane response for an introductory film teacher. I mean, part of your job in introducing someone to the history of film is to show them what were musicals like before that? What were dance scenes like before that? Why was this such an amazing amalgam? What did it do that was different and new? I mean, you have to teach someone about film history so that they can consider those choices and selections and stylistic bits that make it add up to something interesting and remarkable.
But Dana, as someone, you and I have both taught, probably both graduate students and undergraduate students, don't you agree that sometimes you need to shake them out of their snide complacency?
Yeah, I think if I were teaching that film class and I thought that as I was reading the anecdote, I probably would have stopped the film 15, 20 minutes in when I realized that the reaction was turning into an MST3K show and giving everybody a quick chewing out then and asking them to be quiet and pay attention for the rest of the movie. But yeah, as a film professor, you should be rubbing your hands together in glee that you're starting out with a bunch of Philistines, right? Then you have something to do.
I mean, the problem is when you have an intense reaction to a work of art and then someone else responds to it as if it's corny, they are massively invalidating an interior experience that you just had that you believed was totally authentic. And that is excruciatingly painful. And that's going to come up against the social media impulse to share every private response semi-publicly with others. You're going to suddenly discover that what you feel privately about a work of art is unratified.
Right. And in that sense, I really appreciate what Matt wrote, because he plants the idea that we could share things not only in order to snark on them and giggle at them, but we could share them in order to show people who are snarking and giggling what the reaction was that we had that might be valid for them as well.
On the other hand, don't be such a tender flower. Just enjoy the movie. It's okay that other people didn't enjoy it. Not everyone has to have the same experience you had.
All right. Let's endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Well, Steve, I have something that you're going to love this week. You're going to be jealous. You're going to wish that you had come up with my endorsement.
Ooh,
so
I like this, the preemptive endorsement.
I'm going to preemptively say you stole it from me.
So it's this Tumblr website called Speak Celebrity that I found on Twitter through the poet D.A. Powell, who tweeted something about it. Speak Celebrity is essentially celebrities reading poems. I don't know where they come from. I think some of them may be that the celebrity read it in a movie, or maybe they are at a poetry reading, or maybe they specifically for this site came and read the poem. But on Speak Celebrity, you can find such gems as Al Pacino reading William Shakespeare's 150th sonnet, Meryl Streep reading Emily Dickinson's Because I Could Not Stop for Death, Benedict Cumberbatch reading Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll, and just endless riches. So I've been going through the archive, and they're great little, you know, they're tiny poems. Most of them are about 30 to 90 seconds long. And some of the celebrities seem to get the poem perfectly and read it beautifully. Others seem sort of comically befuddled, but it's a really, really fun resource to explore.
Dana, in what alternate universe would I care about this website?
Because, Steve, you are one of the great declaimers of poetry of our time. You have to go and see the competition.
I burn inwardly with a hard gem-like flame, and it is fed not by your celebrity poet speakers.
Julia, what do you have?
Oh, mine is just right on a lofty level up there with Dana. Poetry for the ages, timeless aesthetic forms to consider generations to come. It is a great YouTube video featuring Giancarlo Esposito, whose name I'm just going to try and say as many times as possible because he's such a compelling actor.
Until you get it right.
Oh, how would you do it?
I'm just kidding.
Giancarlo.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. But there is a YouTube video featuring Giancarlo that is titled Best Line Delivery of All Time. And I'm not going to say what he says or what film it's from, but I will post a link to it on the show page. And I recommend that if you enjoy the thespian stylings of Giancarlo Esposito, you will enjoy this 8-second video featuring the best line delivery of all time.
Ooh, mysterious. I can't wait to see it.
Wow. Catnip. I love it. All right. Well, first of all, just very, very quickly, I want to endorse a neologism that a friend of mine came up with almost accidentally over the weekend for people who think they're farmers, you know, the kind of yuppie farmer. He came up with farmer, E-U-R. They're not a farmer, they're a farmer.
Farmer.
Yeah, which I just think is...
Or farmers.
Farmers, but just total genius. But I had to get that out there. That has to get into circulation. And then
the
second,
farmers are going to be shown up in the post-apocalypse.
Exactly. And then secondly, since your Jacobin rage will never be fully satisfied by American culture, you must go back to the source. And I'm telling you, people, this sounds like homework, but it isn't. It is so satisfying. It's one of the great novels I've ever read. Emile Zola's Germinal is so spectacularly weird and sexy and smutty and dirty and filled with class recrimination. And in fact, things are put on spikes. Unmentionable things are put on spikes. You're looking at me like you have not read this book. You are so fired. You've never read Germinal. Germinal is one of the great novels of all time. It has to be read instantly, and I'll even let you do it in translation.
I like that Dana, that Steve is only looking at Dana for that, because he clearly has no expectation that I've read German all. Fairly.
True indeed. Anyway, well, by next week, all of us will have. Yes?
Of course.
Excellent.
Right to the top of the list.
Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, that was fun.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Voilo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. See you next week.
Wondering why it echoes through the lonely palace of Versailles.